It's probably fair to say that most of us take reading for granted. We pick up a book or paper or electronic device, see the words, and away we go. We never think much about the mechanisms, like what it is that allows me to read what I'm saying to you right now. Our guest this hour thinks about those mechanisms a lot. He studies how we read and how the brain processes the information, and he gives a summary of the work in his book, Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Mark Seidenberg is a psychologist and psycholinguist and cognitive neuroscientist, currently working as a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He spent roughly 30 years studying language, reading, and dyslexia. Mark Seidenberg, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Jeffrey.
You make us think from the very start. We really don't think much about how we read, do we?
No, it's something you want to do rather than have to think about how you do it.
Is it kind of like the I come back to the Chuck Knobloch example a lot, the former Yankee second baseman who forgot how to throw to first?
Right, exactly. If you have to think about it, it could get in the way. On the other hand, if you want to understand how it works, then, of course, it's a different endeavor. We have to take it apart and see what's under the hood.
Is it very different from person to person, Mark? I mean, does the tasks that one person does within reading differ that much from person to person?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that people's reading skills differ, and the reasons why they read differ. Some people read, I mean, reading isn't just one thing. It's, are you reading for work? Are you reading for pleasure? Are you reading because you have to or because you elect to? People definitely vary in terms of how reading figures in their lives. However, people don't differ as much as advertised in terms of how they read, how the basic mechanisms work, how the brain is organized for reading. So our experiences and our use of reading differ, but the underlying mechanisms are very similar.
So let's go to the fMRI. I love a good functional MRI, and it sounds like every time we talk to a neuroscientist, we end up with somebody's head in there. What goes on in our brains when we read?
Well, you know, I do this kind of research myself, but I also try to put it into perspective because at this stage, the brain imaging data tells us some important things, and sometimes it's just really complementing things that we already knew from studying behavior. One thing we have learned a lot about reading from these kinds of brain measures because they show us things that are not really obvious from people's behavior. So they give us another source of information, for example, about what is going wrong when a child is struggling to read. The basic story about the brain and reading is that when a child starts to read, a child who's a beginning reader already knows a spoken language. So there's already a circuit in the brain, a complex one, that allows them to comprehend speech and produce speech. They understand the grammar of the language. They understand its communicative uses. They already know spoken language. A beginning reader's problem is to figure out or be shown how this new code they're learning, the print code, connects up with what they already know about language. And that's the story about brain development and reading. The development of knowledge of the written code, spelling, how the words appear on the page, and how that gets integrated with speech. Over time, the two, illiterate people who read, the two, reading and speech, become closely intertwined. Each of them affects the other.
So do we all essentially hear a voice in our head when we read?
Well, that's the way people describe it. What's going on underlyingly, that is, in the brain, is people have that experience for a reason. The reason is having learned about spelling changes the brain's representation of speech and how we experience speech. The opposite also occurs. What we know about speech shapes what we know about spelling. So if you look at parts of the brain that represent spelling, they're shaped by and penetrated by what we know about speech. And if you look at the parts of the brain that are relevant to speech, they become infiltrated by spelling. So the two become so closely intertwined that you end up having the experience when you read that it's something like hearing language in your head.
So I can guess at a problem already. If those areas don't become intertwined, it's going to be more difficult for a person to read.
Indeed. And that is really that is one of the beautiful and interesting results to have come from out of our ability to study brain development in people the scanner who are reading. So it's now been studied in multiple languages that use different kinds of writing systems, English, Chinese, others. And the same thing happens. Namely, reading skill is associated with the integration of print knowledge and knowledge of spoken language. They become like two partners in a very, very closely codependent relationship, and very hard to separate one from another. And this isn't something that, this is universal. It's a sign of skilled reading that the two become paired together. And indeed, the opposite is also true. For children, for adults who have difficulty reading, they have not achieved that kind of integration.
I'm glad you brought up Chinese. Quick question as we head to the break, though, about if the way the brain processes things is very different between Chinese characters, Roman, Arabic, any of that?
It's not really as different as it looks. There are some differences because the characters, the symbols are somewhat different visually. But the basic processes that involve using the print information, sound information, and information about meaning, those things are very, very similar. Our brains are not different. The Chinese brain, the brain of a person reading English, they are solving the reading problem in essentially similar ways. There are little tweaks that are due to the fact that the symbols differ slightly.
All right, much more to talk about. Mark Seidenberg, Language at the Speed of Sight, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mark Seidenberg, cognitive neuroscientist working in the psychology department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's learned a lot about how the human brain processes information as we read, and he's written a book called Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Great conversation to join on the Jefferson Exchange. We welcome your input at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Mark, I mean, if we do know so much, first of all, is it fair to say that literacy appears to be sliding? And if it is, why?
Well, literacy is not getting better. And we've got a long history of relatively low achievement for a country with our resources. So it's not so much that it's sliding as that it's not getting better and it's been poor for a while. So there's a surprisingly large percentage of the population who read very minimally and don't have the skills to participate fully in the society, to help educate their children, to manage their health care, and so on. And we haven't been able to do much about this for decades. This kind of low reader population has existed for as long as anyone has ever measured it, and it hasn't really changed very much. And my problem is that we know a lot about how reading works, and so we should be able to make use of that information and do better.
So let's hit this for the first time. We'll probably come back to it again later. But if we do know so much about reading, is it being applied in how reading is taught then?
No. It's being misapplied, if it's applied at all. So in the book, one of the main things I really try to trace through carefully is the differences between the cultures of science and education. So lots of people are interested in reading and language and learning. On the science side, we think we've learned a lot from studies in lots of languages and lots of labs around the world. Very little of this has any impact on education, which is because educators traditionally have viewed reading from their own perspective. They're not actually that interested in the science. They've developed their own beliefs about how children develop and what's important about reading. In fact, in schools of education today, people don't really talk about teaching children to read. They talk about literacy. Teaching children to read is thought to be boring and a way to kill children's interest in reading. We don't really teach children to read. We try to promote literacy. And in the process, they're leaving aside a huge body of research about what's important to children's progress, what kinds of things really can be built up and how they can be built up. So I would say there's been historically a pretty complete separation between the science on the one hand and educational practices on the other, and the fact that we haven't been able to get any movement on this is one of the reasons I wrote the book.
And at its heart, I mean, you claim in the book that reading is central to who we are as humans. So expand on that, if you would.
Well, I think it's an obvious point. I mean, one thing about reading is that it is an amazingly complex skill. It is one of the extraordinary accomplishments of, you know, human existence. I mean, people debate whether, for example, there's much commonality between spoken language and the communicative systems of animals. And there are some overlap. They're not the same, but you can at least see that there are some things that are similar. But there's no other species that has anything like reading. And in fact, humans didn't have reading for most of our existence. Reading was an invention, and it took a very long time to get to, and it's only existed for the last several thousand years. So reading is pretty extraordinary. It's unique among human capacities, and obviously it's crucial to survival in the world. The literacy demands of the society are growing. They're not getting less.
That is for sure. We have to read more than ever, and that brings us to some of the ways in which we do read now. You quickly do get to texting and the constant use of our cell phones for readable messages to each other. How does the brain light up for that activity? Does it light up differently than it does for just reading on the paper?
Well, I try to avoid talking about lighting up because, you know, most of your brain is lighting up most of the time.
The whole idea about 10% of your brain is not good, right?
Well, I just try to, you know, remind people that there's a very complicated set of circuits here, and often the pictures that you see are drawn that way or colored that way to highlight some part of it. But your question is, texting is not a big deal. It's basically building on existing knowledge of spoken language and writing. And in terms of the brain circuits and the kinds of processes involved in texting, they're not really, they just build on existing sorts of abilities and just happen to use them in a new sort of circumstance. So there's not that much interesting about texting in terms of influencing brain structure or organization or anything. It's just kind of an add-on. It might have been interesting if, for example, you know, 12-year-olds who are texting 5,000 times a month and using all sorts of shortcuts, somehow that interfered with their ability to learn how to spell and their grammar and everything else. The fears about that have not really seemed to be overblown. The research that's been done suggests that kids can separate out texting from other uses of language, and so it's convenient and they do it, and it's really kind of just doesn't take the place of learning how to spell, but it's not going to greatly interfere with it either.
Mark Seidenberg is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Do you see then, Mark, does texting help at all? I mean, it's getting people to read where they used to just talk to each other.
I don't think that it's really helpful for reading or literacy. It might be helpful for communication, although that gets into other issues about, is this really, you know, it's a different form of communication and has pluses and minuses. It's not really relevant to literacy because it's basically pretty low-level stuff. I mean, one could argue the problem with discourse in this country over controversial issues is that we're, you know, pumping out very short messages that don't contain much content, Twitter,
sure,
and other things like that. Mm-hmm. It's a negative if that's the only kind of reading and writing that one does. It doesn't have the depth and doesn't allow the deeper investigation of issues and exchange of ideas that other media do. But it doesn't improve one's literacy. It's just not necessarily going to harm a kid's development as long as they are pressed to read more challenging texts.
Well, and as you point out, too, that that moods and stresses and things like that don't appear in text, so we can't convey the full impact of what we're feeling, not just because it's short, but also because it's written. But that's present in all forms of writing. You don't get to hear the sound of a person's voice, but it seems like when you were talking about the fact that this is really just an expansion of what we learned in speech, because we have spoken language before we have written language, that really helps us as we read to get the context and the mood and the meaning of what's being written on the page.
Indeed. So a person can't understand a text unless they're able to add information that's missing, information that they can add because they know about speech. So if I say, this is a really important statement, or the fact that I've stressed important in that way conveys some information that wouldn't necessarily come across in the way that it's written. Look, when people read, they are always filling in missing information. The missing information is things like, tone of voice, things about attitude, things about emphasis that is easy to convey in spoken language, but has to be filled in when we read. Reading is dependent on speech. It's dependent, if you want to read a joke and understand the joke, you have to be able to hear it in your head in order to get the punchline. So we're always using our knowledge of spoken language when we read. We're always filling in things that are missing from print. That's not just texting. That's not just certain forms of reading. That is a pervasive aspect of reading. It's necessary.
Mark Seidenberg, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It, and your thoughts about reading and how we're doing it in our society today and how we're doing it literacy generally. Welcome here on the Jefferson Exchange. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. You do get into a history of writing and reading. Basically, does written language correspond with the earliest civilizations?
Well, it does, and indeed it arose in parts of the world where the demand for writing emerged because they had developed commerce and the need for bookkeeping. Why it was developed in, say, the present Middle East, and how many times people invented reading, right? It's basically somebody had to figure out how writing works. Writing is a way of representing spoken language in a more permanent form. Somebody had to figure out how to do that, and how exactly that was done, and in how many places is something that people debate because, there was nobody there writing down their thinking as they went along, and so it's left to us to kind of try to figure it out from the archaeological record, and that's hard to do. But it's definitely the case that writing appeared in societies where there was relatively advanced trading culture and agriculture and so on, and indeed out of a need for bookkeeping.
There are some interesting sections of the book where you give us a look at how language changed over the years, and I'm really curious about some of the places where things got complicated. I mean, it's easy to represent water or fish or livestock or something, but when you start getting into the more difficult concepts like love or something, I mean, how do you end up making pictures for those?
Right. So I think it's fun to try to put yourself, if you can, in the position of people 5,000 years ago who can speak their spoken language. You can think of it as being like ours, and they're able to communicate and perform all sorts of, communicative functions. And then somebody has to figure out, it would be useful to have this more permanent record. And there's two enormous questions. The first one is, the first pictures, the cave art that everyone knows and is so famous, those date from more than 30,000 years ago. So 30,000 years ago, people had gotten the idea of representational art, that is depiction. You could draw a horse, you could draw a hand or a face. It takes 30,000 years to get from the drawing of the horse to writing systems that allow you to talk about it, to write about horses, to say more things about horses, to represent the word horse in a written form. That was a huge step. It took a very long time because the very idea that we now take for granted, that we have writing systems and they represent language, had to occur to someone. And it was apparently it was overlooked for eons. And so the first question is, how did anybody ever get that idea? The second question is, once they got the idea that this would be a good thing, if we write down horse, then we have a symbol for horse, then we can talk about trading horses and number of horses and counting them and so on. Then there was the further challenge, which is, how can we develop a written system that will represent anything we can say, that is, a whole language? And that takes another 3,000 or so years. So all of these developments are very, very slow, which gives you some idea about how hard they were to achieve.
Truly, truly. And of course, you know, in developing the systems, we had to figure out how to make it clear to other people how to decode them as well. And that gets to the whole reading part. Let's take a call here. We have Bob and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Seidenberg, the author of Language at the Speed of Sight.
Thank you. I'd like to speak just a minute about texting, because I feel that it's done by an awful lot of people now, and frequently it's young people. And there's an aspect of texting which has to do with something you addressed, Jeffrey, and that's the emojis. The emojis can show emotion, and there are so many emojis now just for that kind of thing that I think it's possible with texting to augment it with your emojis and show emotion and show feeling.
Huh, so you're conveying it even with just the limit of characters you got there.
Yeah, but it's not limited. I mean, there are hundreds of emojis.
Right.
And there are all kinds. I don't know if either of you spend very much time on it, but there's quite a selection of emojis, so that it's not just two or three simple things to show.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I'm just wondering whether enough study is being done with that, because it sort of sounds like you're saying, well, texting is really not language. And it is written language. You have to be able to spell to do texting. And texting also has its own spelling. So what about that? What about changing with the spelling of things to shorter forms that the people who are texting are developing? Because this is a whole developing area.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Well, you know, some of the things the caller says are true, and some of them are a little off to the side. So it's true that emojis allow you to express the emotional things, more generally, a person's attitude. So whether a sentence is a statement or sarcastic or humorous, or has some other communicative intent, is very hard to express in a very short text. And so people add the emoji as a way of disambiguating what they're writing, adding that information in. And in the context of texting, where the messages are short and there's not a lot of options for editing and going back, then the emoji is a useful shortcut. However, when we're writing outside of that texting context, we have other ways of expressing whether the idea is sarcastic, whether it is ironic, whether it is a statement of fact, and so on. So texting is a mashup. It's a mashup of reading, and it's with spoken language. It fulfills a certain communicative niche, the one that we all make use of in communicating short messages to each other. It is a form of language, but it differs because of the particular conditions imposed by these devices, and it is not the same. It's just an offshoot, a sort of derived form of language that kind of is a mishmash. And that doesn't mean it's not useful for certain functions, but that doesn't mean it does a better job at what reading longer texts, reading and writing longer texts allow us to do.
It was interesting that Bob brought that up just as we were talking about the development of written language in the first place, which had to move from pictures into more abstract terms. But the fact is we're back to using pictures again now.
Yeah, but, you know, picture, I think one has to emphasize the limited niche role that these play. So if your intent is to convey whether you're being serious or joking or something else in a very short message, an emoji is fine. However, you do not want to use those emojis in the context where clarity and specificity matters. You're going to need a longer text for that, and you can do that in Word.
All right. Coming up, more to talk with Mark Seidenberg about reading and the mechanisms in the brain and how we use the information we've gotten now. Language at the speed of sight, how we read, why so many can't, and what can be done about it. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mark Seidenberg. He's a psychologist, psycholinguist, and cognitive neuroscientist, currently working as a professor at the Department of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's written a book that really makes us think about what we do when we read. It's called Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. You're welcome to join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about literacy skills, how we acquire them, or what prevents us from acquiring them fully. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you do get into mechanisms here, and what do our eyes do when we read, Mark?
Well, our eyes, when we read, are doing what they do when we're looking at other kinds of things like scenes and the world around us. Of course, they're scanning lines, and they're doing so in a series of fixations and jumps. So you look at a word for a while, and then you decide, and you shift your eyes to the next word. There's a lot of mythology around what people's eyes do when they read. Speed reading programs always incorporate the idea that if you try hard enough and you practice hard enough, you can train yourself to take in more letters at a time, or even whole lines at a time. But this is a falsehood. It just goes against the basic neuroanatomy of the visual system. There's only a certain amount of information that the eye can take in on a single fixation while you're looking at a particular word. The window over which you bring in information is pretty narrow, and there's no way to will yourself to take in more information at a time. That would be like saying we could just will ourselves to hear sounds, you know, that are in the dog whistle range. I mean, we cannot will ourselves to see more because of the limitations of the eye. And so it's a kind of intuition that has given rise to decades and decades of speed reading scams that say, just learn to take in whole lines or whole paragraphs at a time. That won't work. At best, what you'll do if you try that is you'll learn how to skim.
Well, it's interesting you bring this up, and particularly because you bring up the Evelyn Wood speed reading system. And I remember the TV commercials for that back in the 70s and 80s where they showed these people just moving their finger really rapidly down the page. You provide an exercise of your own for readers of the book to do, one where you just follow one finger. And yes, your eyes can follow that smoothly. But when you put up two fingers and try to cover the gap between them, your eyes bump across everything in between, which is what we have to do. We have to look at every face in the crowd, essentially, don't we?
Yes. This is a case where Mother Nature has the upper hand. Your visual system did not evolve for reading. We have our visual systems. They solve various kinds of problems very well, and reading, like lines on the page, are a new use for vision. Our eyes, when we read across of the page, we don't have the option of moving our eyes smoothly. We don't have the neural control to be able to do that. We can only move in this fixate, that is, look, pause, and then jump kind of mechanism. That's built in. It's not something that can be changed. And so reading has to work within those constraints. And what it means is that your eyes are not the key to reading skill. Your eyes are just doing their job reading what's on the page. The keys to reading skill are that you understand what you are reading. You have familiarity with the topic. You understand what your goals are in reading. That allows people to read somewhat faster, but it does not allow people to suddenly take in entire pages. And that thing about scanning your finger down the page, I trace back the history of that to like the 1960s. It's just utterly bogus. There's nothing that happens from that except guiding people into skimming the text.
Ah, okay. Nothing squishy about what you said right there then. Okay. Which you know, leads us to other things that people have proposed about how the human brain works with language. We're starting to see those things on the internet on a pretty regular basis. If you can read this and the words are scrambled and the vowels are taken out. And this leads us to the Cambridge hoax, which is actually, if you want to get to the technical spelling, is more like the Cambridge hoax.
Yeah.
Which was what?
Well, a number of years ago, this fascinating little paragraph went around the internet. It still bounces around. And it was that one where the text said something like, you know, researchers at Cambridge University have shown that you don't really have to pay attention to the letters in words. All you have to do is look at the first and last letter and you'll be able to read. And the thing that was interesting about this meme was that you could read this text with the letters scrambled. So, you know, the words were misspelled, but somehow you could still read it. Well, that was an interesting demonstration, but what they concluded from this was wrong. It's not the case that you can read if the letters in the words are scrambled just anyway. That person actually cheated and only scrambled them certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes the text much harder to read. You can read it if you have time to think about it, guess, figure it out. But, you know, it was a half-truth. And in the book I go through very carefully, you know, here's what's true about it, here's what's not true about it. And the idea that some people, who knows what to believe on the internet. There are educators who teach this claims from this Cambridge reading hoax that you don't have to pay attention to the letters because they can be scrambled and they can still recognize words. People teach this as though it is true. It's not actually true. And it's a source of misinformation. So I tried to correct that in the book.
And in fact, in the book, you tongue-in-cheek propose license requirements for a certified skilled reader and point out the long set of skills that are involved in reading. And we're talking about, you know, the movement of the eyes and the conversion in the brain to spoken language, as we understand it, and a lot of other components there. Given that we know all this, Mark, can we figure out where people are falling down in reading and tweak that one portion of it or the two skills that they're not quite getting?
Yes, we can. And we're getting better at doing that all the time. So the question is, you have to know what skills to be looking for. So it's important to know how reading works so that a person could be sensitive to, oh, is it this component that's the problem or that component's the problem? Because indeed, if one has a proper understanding of how reading works and the kinds of areas where kids encounter problems, then that makes it possible to focus on those problem areas and try to bring them up to speed. We're getting better and better at this because this is an area where neuroimaging and understanding how the brain is structured and differences between the good and poor readers at the neural level is making it possible to be more precise about what to build and what to work around. The problem is teachers are led to believe that they can figure this out just by observing kids and working with them. And teachers are great, and they work extremely hard to figure out their jobs. But learning how reading works and figuring out what's going on in the brain of a particular kid is something that you just can't do from personal observation. It takes the kind of research that we do to really figure it out. And so the fact that teachers aren't exposed to this other stuff we know is making their jobs a lot harder.
Let us take a call here. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Seidenberg, the author of Language at the Speed of Sight.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I myself was a very slow reader, although I'm a voracious one. And as an adult in the 30s, I helped do a literacy program here. And I noticed, you know, as a non-pathologist or a person not trained in speech or writing or that sort of thing, I could not force a person to read more quickly. And I was assuming at the time that it was because the person simply was not processing. You know, one particular fellow really tried hard, but there was, you know, if there was a scrambling occurring in the brain or something like that neurologically, it's obvious, regardless of how many times he tried, he could not go more quickly through the words or comprehend them more quickly. And, you know, given that our schools have so little funding now, and as you say, the teachers are trying, I really worry that so many people will fall behind or fall out of school just because they cannot do this processing at the right rate for whatever neurological reason. Your book sounds absolutely fascinating, and I hope a lot of people read it. Thank you.
Thanks, Connie. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Mark?
Those were great points, and let me just try to speak to a couple of them. One of them is, no, you cannot force people to read more quickly. People read more quickly as the result of gaining certain kinds of skills. So the question is, if a person is not reading reading smoothly, efficiently, what are the kinds of knowledge and skills that are lacking? And there can be several things. And you didn't say any, the caller didn't say much about how old the individuals are, but here are some of the things that matter. One is stuff that comes from the environment. So what is this person's spoken language like? What is their spoken language vocabulary like? What is their ability to understand speech, things that they're, language when it's spoken to them? Often, reading problems are secondary to issues with speech. The person's vocabulary is limited. They're not familiar with a very wide range of syntactic structures. There's all sorts of things that about people's spoken language that can be limited, and that carries over into reading. Person can't understand the words, read the words, understand them, if they're not in their spoken language vocabulary. So some of these things, problems, can develop for reasons that are just could have been corrected. Could have been corrected early, are harder to correct when they're later, by providing them with better experience with spoken language and better instruction that would get them off the ground and into reading at a young age. Now, those are environmental things that we can do something about. In some individuals, they are constituted in ways that make reading particularly difficult. So these are people who we call dyslexic. We know a great deal about how their brains are developing, the kinds of differences in brain development that might not have a huge impact on the person's thinking or their speech or other things, but really, really interfere with their reading. So when a person is of the sort the listener described, where they're just struggling with reading, one has to ask, is some of this from lack of experience and feedback and instruction, and is some of this due to a constitutional kind of problem that really is making it particularly difficult for this person? Of course, we have to try to work with the person and work and do whatever we can, regardless of the source. But I want to point out that, you know, some of these are very easy to deal with by giving people appropriate experiences, especially by teaching them properly. And others are harder to deal with but can be addressed because there's something about the way the person is constructed that is interfering with reading.
So are you saying that it's more often a case that you'll get a learning disability in a child who has not perhaps been around a lot of varied vocabulary? I mean, does it track that closely?
No. Well, it's not quite like you said. These two things go together. They're not, in real life, they are not separable. We have experience, and we have how we are developing as individuals, in particular how our brains develop and how our brains support behavior like reading. So the two are going back and forth, interacting, and it's a challenge for scientists to separate these things out, but that's what we try to do. in real life, they're interacting with one another. What we know is, first of all, there are some aspects of brain development that can interfere with learning to read much more than they interfere with other skills. Sometimes they also interfere with things like math. Sometimes they also go along with attention deficit disorder. We know that the brain can develop in ways that cause difficulties in these areas, and that's true. On the other hand, experience is constantly modulating the effects of genetics and gene expression and brain development. So the two are going back and forth, and there is quite a lot of room to influence brain development in positive ways that will prevent dyslexia and other sorts of developmental disorders. We have to work to be knowledgeable about both sides.
It's a pretty amazing book in the sense that we really have to stop and think about the things that we never stop and think about, which is the mechanisms that go into reading and how those can be interrupted. The book is called Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Mark Seidenberg wrote the book and joined us today in the exchange. And Mark, for that, we thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care.